Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. My name is Corey Fleck and I'm your host for this weekend's edition. Shad, my co-host, is on vacation this week, has been throughout the week, so I will be taking the reins of this full weekend show. Man, oh man, this week again, it just continues to be volatile in nature, and now some even interesting moves on the commodity front as we saw copper drop below $4, energy has continued to sell off, a couple maybe kinks in the armor, more kinks in the armor for the underlying economy as both of those can be economic barometers, and hey, who knows, maybe the Fed is starting to bring down inflation a little bit. Although the most recent reading still has remained quite high. We're going to cover a wide range of commodity-related investment products as well as some of the big picture outcomes or outlooks for the economy and markets. I'm kicking off the show with Adrian Day, president of Adrian Day Asset Management, also manager of the Euro-Pacific Gold Fund. Adrian, I want to quickly start off with a quick recap of the PDAC. That happened about a week and a half to 2 weeks ago in Toronto. It was pushed back from its normal March time frame into June due to some of the COVID issues that Canada was still dealing with back at the time. Generally, I've heard a bit more of an upbeat attitude or recap from PDAC in terms of at least more people being on the floor. Of course, PDAC timed perfectly with another market sell-off and another sell-off in gold and the gold stocks. That PDAC curse never seems to leave us. Adrian, what was your takeaway from PDAC this year, this time in June?
Yeah, well, good morning, Corey, and thank you for having me. No, I agree. PDAC was actually much more, there were far more people attending than I feared. As you say, the PDAC curse remains. It doesn't seem to matter what time of year they do it. There were noticeably far fewer attendees from overseas. There's normally a very strong Chinese contingent. Normally a lot of African countries send a lot of people. Far fewer this year, but I think that just reflects the fact that they had to make plans, you know, months in advance, and months in advance there were still COVID restrictions. So anyway, more people than I expected, and definitely an upbeat general tone. But you know, I've said this so many times. I mean, you're not in the gold business if you're not optimistic. You know, you have
optimistic
to be
optimistic on gold, not optimistic on the economy, not optimistic on government, not optimistic on markets, just optimistic on gold. Right, Adrian?
Absolutely optimistic on gold. And so, but I think the other thing, so you always, I mean, that tone is more normal than not. But there are a lot of juniors or smaller companies, exploration companies that have projects of varying degrees, you know, drilled, not drilled, etc. But they have attractive projects, and there was definitely a lot of senior companies looking. You know, we won't know how many deals were concluded for a few months because they're, you know, they always continue after the show. But there was definitely noticeably a lot of interest, and I think that reflects obviously both the ongoing need for the seniors to add to ounces, but it also reflects the fact that, you know, more juniors actually have things of potential interest now.
Adrian, one deal that did come out of PDAC, or at least during that PDAC conference, was Gold Standard Ventures being taken over by Orla Mining. While this takeover happened, it unfortunately is another example where not many of the Gold Standard Ventures shareholders made much money, unless they bought in the last, I think it was a couple weeks to a month. That stock had continued to drop over 5 to 6 years. What was your takeaway from that deal that even some people on our show have said it's more of a take under than a takeover?
Yeah, I didn't actually own, I don't own either of those two stocks, so I wasn't very close to it. But I feel the pain. We've had in the past, not recently, but we've had in the past cases where, you know, you buy a stock thinking it's going to get taken over, and then eventually you're proven right, but you lose money. That is very frustrating. That's all I can say on that. But, you know, it reflects the current state of the market. I mean, you know, there was a premium, and there was a premium to the market, and people don't have to sell. People don't have to vote in favor if they don't want to.
That is true. Now, in terms of PDAC, one thing that we always see at the conference, and to your point about less international visitors or investors being there, we see a lot of representation from different South American countries, whether it's Peru, they're usually out on the floor, Ecuador, they're out there handing out stuff. However, we've seen a lot of bad news come out of South American countries. Generally, Latin America continues to struggle with their political status, and it's shying investors away, especially in the resource front. What's your takeaway from generally South America as a jurisdiction right now?
Well, South America obviously is a big place and diverse, but you're absolutely correct. I mean, the trend is definitely going leftwards in across the entire continent. I can't think of any country that's bucking the trend at the moment. It's just really a matter of when's the next election. But, you know, Latin America has over the years typically swung, hasn't it, from sort of left to right and back again over the years. But it does definitely look as though we're in that trend where all the countries are going left, and even Brazil, you know, Lula is ahead in the polls at the moment. Now, you know, most of my friends in Brazil tell me, no way is he going to win. How can people ask for a repeat of the last time? But I think that's a little bit of bias, frankly, the fact that they don't like him. I mean, the truth is, however bad some of the things Lula did, including the, you know, car wash scandal, which was at its height under his administration, the economy really wasn't that bad. So it's definitely a leftward trend, and a lot of people are saying, oh, you know, people are exaggerating, it's not as bad as all that, they're going to Chile, you know, we're not going to nationalize the mines, et cetera, et cetera. And I fully agree, things are not going to be, in most countries, things are not going to be as bad as people are fearing, some people are fearing, but it's still a negative. We're still going backwards in terms of the ability of particularly, say, copper miners to build new mines, to produce more copper, or their willingness to produce more copper. Companies like Freeport, for example, Acquisition has said, you know, we've got projects in Peru and Chile, but we are not proceeding with them until there's more clarity on the political situation there. And they're not the only ones, of course. So definitely this is a negative. The only, you know, offsetting thing, I would say two things to offset it. One is, as I said, it's a pendulum. And I think it'll be interesting to see what happens in Mexico with their next election. I think it's next year. I should know. I'm sorry. But their next election, you know, there's a lot of disenchantment in certain circles with AMLO. You know, if Mexico then, shall we say, swings right, and it's not going to be really right wing, but swings away from the left, then that might portend, okay, the pendulum's reached its limit, and now we're going to swing back. The other thing I would say is that historically, over the last 40, 50 years, 60 years in fact, if you are in a stagflationary period, particularly a period when commodities are doing well, which they normally do in a stagflation, and particularly if the U.S. dollar is going down, that tends to be a good period for most Latin American markets. So I'm not going to write the economy off, the continent off yet, but I'm certainly not aggressively buying at this point.
Okay, so maybe we're at a bottom for some of these South American countries. That recent news out of Colombia on that election definitely drove down some of the stocks focused in Colombia, but early on, when an election result is announced, there's a lot of volatility and a lot of sometimes capitulation around those events. We'll see how that all plays out there. What was your takeaway from that Colombia election?
Yeah, I don't really follow Colombia that closely, but I was surprised, to be honest. I'm surprised that after everything that country's been through with this narco war, and, you know, thousands, hundreds, tens of thousands of people being killed. I'm just surprised that people would elect, you know, one of the guerrillas to run the government, especially since it's not as though the country was doing that badly. You know, but since the end of the civil war, you know, the economy had been doing reasonably well and was coming back. So I'm just very surprised that people would vote for that. But then I'd also be surprised people in Brazil would vote for more Lula, and surprised in Argentina that they vote for, you know, yet another Kirchner as vice president. So not everybody agrees with me, I guess.
All right, Adrian, let's move on to copper. I want to get your outlook on copper, because as much bullishness as I've heard around copper, long-term supply and demand imbalances, and how the world needs more copper, and how big mines are starting to run out of ore. Fact of the matter is, when we look shorter term for copper, it is a pretty good economic barometer or indicator. And copper, just this week on Wednesday, dropped below $4. It had been in a range of around $4.20 up to a high of $5 over the last about year. But now the copper is dropping. Is this telling us a little bit more big picture wise about the issues that underlying economies could be in, and even moving into inflation, that inflation might be coming down?
I think it's more an indicator on the economy than it is on inflation. As people, and this has been a broad, not just in the commodity sector, but it's been a broad increase in concern about recession in the U.S. and about the global economy slowing. As those concerns increase, then obviously if you're a copper consumer and your outlook for recession, you know, the odds of recession pick up, well, you buy less copper. You don't stockpile copper, etc. So, you know, the supply-demand gets out of balance and the copper price goes down. And that is, it has been traditionally, a very good indicator of future economic growth. So, you know, that indicator is not at all optimistic at the moment. But the thing I would say about copper, even if you take what you might call a base case or a reasonably cautious case on demand for copper over the next 5 years, meaning a slowdown in the global economy, a particular slowdown in China. China's demand on a longer-term basis is plateauing, I think, after, you know, huge growth in consumption of copper over the last 20 years, but it's plateauing on a longer-term basis. Regardless of the lockdowns we had, that obviously reduced the demand for copper earlier in the year, but on a longer term basis, even if you make the cautious assessment that the switch to electrification globally is going to go slower than some people are anticipating, which I certainly think is realistic, but even if you make all those assumptions on the cautious side, the plain fact is that the demand for copper is in 3 to 5 years' time is still going to exceed the projected supply of copper in 3 to 5 years' time. And that means higher prices. The thing about copper, as we've discussed before, unlike, say, you know, particularly gold at the other extreme, is that it takes a long time. It takes many years for a copper mine to come into production. Even shovel-ready projects, from the time a board of directors gives an approval to go ahead, a major mine would take 5 to 7 years to start producing. And so we can be reasonably sure of the amount of copper that is going to be produced, certainly in 3 years, certainly in 5 years. And there's just not enough copper coming on stream in that time period to meet the demand, even on a cautious assessment of demand. So I'm certainly not negative on copper. I mean, the price could come down in the near term, absolutely, particularly if China and the global economy, you know, slides backwards. The U.S., I think a recession is virtually inevitable. But on a longer term basis, I'm positive. And some of the stocks, you know, I think are good buys here. You know, the big cap stocks like Freeport, for example, you know, I mean, it's a $32 down, $31 down from over 50 2 months ago. And if a 50 was a little bit high on the high side. 31 is I think overdoing the negative.
What about financing these mines? Because copper mines, while they are big, while they do produce for long periods of time, decades on end, they cost a lot of money to finance. And I've heard a lot of stories about miners not getting all that favorable of terms when it comes to debt packages, credit facilities, what have you. That in itself can hold back development of mines. Do you see this environment improving? And how important is it to note this environment and how tough it has been to finance these builds?
Oh, no, that's absolutely critical. That's a critical point, Corey. I mean, and banks are pulling in the horns worldwide, and banks are going to be much more reluctant, to lend $500 million for a copper mine in the Congo or in Chile or wherever it might be. But there's a lot of sources of financing for these companies, including, of course, streams, streams from royalty companies and companies like Franco, for example, as well as some of the other big ones, Wheaton. They're not afraid of financing a copper mine to get the gold and silver byproduct. So, I think good projects will be able to get financed on reasonable terms. It might be more of a stream and less debt, or it might be debt from more banks on less favorable terms. But I think they'll be able to get them financed if it's a good project. It's definitely a concern, but I think, before you even get to the financing, companies like Freeport have to say, yes, we're ready to commit $800 million to this project in Chile or in Peru, given what's going on. And I think you're going to see a reluctance, just as we're seeing in the oil and gas industry, to the most extreme case, but you're going to see a cautiousness, if not a reluctance, on the part of a lot of mining companies to commit huge amounts of capital into jurisdictions where the sentiment is not favorable. Now, in the case of copper, I think we would say that Arizona, for example, or the Southwest United States, is generally a favorable jurisdiction for copper. It's not favorable for oil and gas. And I mean, we know that President Biden is pointing his finger at the oil and gas companies, but I mean, these companies don't want to commit huge amounts of gas, as Exxon said very, very eloquently in their letter to President Biden, followed up a couple of days later by Chevron. It's not just a matter of tweaking this or tweaking that. It's a matter of changing the attitude and the sentiment. The government, as Exxon said, has been critical, if not outright hostile, to the industry. That doesn't make the industry want to commit tens or even hundreds, but tens of millions of dollars for projects that may not return profits, for 5 years. You want a friendly or a more neutral or friendly environment before you do that.
Yeah, and that's been the biggest issue with some of these copper assets is that they are in these jurisdictions that people don't want to spend not just $800 million, but a couple billion dollars to build out. Final question on copper and copper deposits then. What makes a good copper deposit in your eyes? Because we have a lot of multi-billion pound copper assets out there that show reasonable economics that still aren't getting built. So what makes a copper asset stand out in your eyes?
Well, the jurisdiction is important. It's always nice if they have some kind of, it might be a gold cap, for example, but gets you a quicker payback, gets you some revenue quickly so you get a quicker payback. But to me, it's the same sort of thing that makes any deposit attractive, and in copper in particular, the jurisdiction is becoming a much more critical aspect.
Okay, yeah, jurisdiction also key, but again, a lot of these well-known copper deposits in these jurisdictions that large money or even big banks don't necessarily want exposure to. Let's now talk about gold, more so the gold stocks, because gold has been relatively boring. It's been, for the most part, doing its job during this broad sell-off in the markets. It's been preserving value while most everything has been falling. Yeah, gold might not be moving up at the same rate as inflation, but again, everything else, for the most part, has been selling off. The gold stocks, though, those keep on selling off. Even the big guys, the whole way down to the little guys, and the little guys, boy, oh boy, they've just been getting crushed for well over a year now. Why can't these gold stocks get some sort of support or some sort of interest here, Adrian?
Yeah, well, let's just reiterate what you just said. Gold is actually up year to date, basically flat, but it's actually up year to date. And other than other commodities, apart from other commodities, I can't think of any other assets, markets, sectors that are up this year. So it is doing its job, and it's important that we remember that. And the reason that most of the commodities are still up is, of course, because of Russia and the boost they got from Russia. So gold is doing well. Gold stocks are down, you know, whatever, 7% or something, the seniors this year, which is not catastrophic compared with what's happened to the S&P, you know, in the last 6 weeks. What I would say is that it is not at all unusual for the gold stocks when the broad market falls. It's not at all unusual for the gold stocks to fall with the broad market initially, and frequently they will fall more than the broad market. But equally, it's not at all unusual for the gold stocks to bottom sooner and recover more rapidly than the broad market. You can look at 1987, 2000 with the dot-com bust, 2008. It's true in all those cases, the gold stocks recovered more than the broad market in the 3, 6, 12 months following the sell-off. And I think we're going to see the same sort of thing this time. So I'm not, you know, if you look at previous patterns, I don't see this as anything to be overly concerned about. On the contrary, I think this is a pretty darn good time to be buying. And I think we'll see the gold stocks bottom before we see the S&P bottom.
Historically, that is what we've seen, and then an outperformance by the gold stocks. But remember, that outperformance, sometimes it's a year, sometimes it's a little less than that, and then money seems to rotate back into the broad averages. Who knows if that'll happen again, but boy, oh boy, these gold stocks have been sold off. Final point then, Adrian, something that you wrote to your subscribers, your clients most recently was the portfolio positioning for a metals portfolio when it comes to some of these gold stocks, because even though the majors, the large caps, aren't down as much as the juniors, we usually see the larger companies move first. And quite frankly, they could weather any more downside that we could have over the rest of summer. Take us through your strategy when it comes to putting together a metals or a precious metals portfolio in this environment when everything has been sold off.
Yeah, no, good question. I mean, two things. One is, as you say, the environment. In a much more risky environment where maybe raising capital is going to be a little more difficult, you know, you want to go with the better capitalized and the more risk-averse companies. Now, any gold company has risk, but more particularly, any gold company is going to be volatile. There's no way to get around that. Even the biggest and the best are going to be volatile. But I think in this kind of environment, you want to go with ones that have a better chance of withstanding it. And that means better capitalization. It also means, frankly, a little more liquidity in stocks. The other thing I would say, though, is in this current environment where we are right now, you know, the major mining stocks are very, very inexpensive on a fundamental basis. And when, you know, there's that old saying, you know, don't buy hamburger when the fillet's on sale. And if you can buy the biggest and the best at good values, I personally don't see that you ought to be, you know, going down the food chain that much. So when you look at a company like Barrick, I've mentioned, you know, just as an example, and I do like Barrick, but just as an example, you know, Barrick under $20, you know, is trading very close to its all-time lows in terms of price to cash flow, which simply doesn't make sense. You look at the dividend, indicated dividend of over 4%. It's an attractive dividend in and of itself in this environment. So that's just an example. I'm just looking at that as an example. But when you can buy stocks like Barrick and Agnico and Pan American and Wheaton, Royal Gold, Osisko Gold, when you can buy these well-capitalized, well-run, large companies with liquidity, that's important. You know, I think that's certainly where you start. And I'm not averse to, whatever you want to say, taking flyers on exploration companies. But, you know, for the bulk of a portfolio in this environment, I would stick with the bigger and the better companies.
All right, Adrian, thanks for sharing some of those companies that you're liking. And hey, all your thoughts on these markets. Always a pleasure chatting with you, Adrian. Always a pleasure getting your updates on the markets. And sounds like this summer still might be a bit slow for everybody, but overall, there should be opportunity when these markets turn. Who knows when that'll happen, though. Adrian, thank you again for your time. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend, and we'll chat again next month.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.